Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Juravich, a show where we share stories and information about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're going to talk about two big changes for two of the most popular social media platforms, a looming ban for TikTok in the U.S., and Meta announced it's ditching its fact checkers. We'll start with TikTok and what's likely to happen Sunday. That's when a U.S. ban is set to go into effect. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case last week. Joining us now is Wall Street Journal technology reporter Megan Bobrowski. Based in San Francisco, she covers TikTok, Meta, and other social media. Welcome to All Sides, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
So TikTok, they were before the Supreme Court about this. What are the arguments on each side of the case when it comes to TikTok?
Yeah, so the government is really trying to paint this as a national security issue. And on the flip side, TikTok is trying to paint this as a First Amendment free speech issue and arguing that American users have a right to access TikTok.
And the justices seem to zero in on those arguments. When you were listening to them go back and forth with the different attorneys, what vibe were you getting from the justices about their feelings on TikTok?
Yeah, it was interesting because they're going to ask hard questions of both sides. Mm-hmm. But I came away from it feeling like TikTok got asked more hard questions than the government did, and that the justices maybe weren't buying TikTok's arguments as much. From my listening of it, it seemed like the justices viewed it more as a national security case versus a First Amendment free speech case.
When you were listening, did you get the feeling at all that any of the Supreme Court justices actually use TikTok? Did they?
That's a good question, and a question I've been asked before. It's hard to know. I mean, they didn't really say much about whether they actually used the app, but they really honed in on this idea of national security and needing to divest from China. And what the justices seemed to find palatable about the law actually was the fact that it's not just an outright ban on TikTok, it's a ban or divestiture. So if TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, is willing to sell TikTok to a non-Chinese company, then TikTok would still be allowed to operate in the US. And there's actually precedent for this. An LGBT dating app called Grindr, if you're familiar with that one, also had a Chinese owner, and they were forced to sell to a non-Chinese owner. So, you know, there is some precedent for this type of sale. And so the justices seem to think that that was a fair stipulation in the law.
Chief Justice John Roberts said Congress did not want to stop TikTok, meaning the speech or ideas being expressed. They want to stop Chinese control. He was skeptical of the speech rights part, right?
Yes. So it's interesting. The government's case was actually a little bit weaker on First Amendment grounds. The justices seemed amenable to the idea that Americans do have a First Amendment right, but they just didn't view the case as a First Amendment case. They viewed it as this case of corporate ownership and potential national security conflicts. And so from that perspective, again, having the divestiture or the ban, they seem to be okay with that.
So on Sunday, without any further action, what happens? Apple and Google are legally forced to remove the app from app stores?
That's correct. So if nothing else happens, Apple and Google would be forced to remove the app from the app stores. Users who have it downloaded are still allowed to have it. There's no stipulation in the law requiring users to delete the app. Mm-hmm. The problem is once you take an app out of the app store, it can no longer be updated. Mm-hmm. So over time, it would just become more buggy and unusable and actually pose some security risks to users. So that's not an ideal situation at all. So alternatively, TikTok's owner ByteDance could just shut down the app in the US.
Hmm. And have you heard of a buyer stepping forward? I mean, I don't know. Does the owner of TikTok want to sell? Do you think they're going to be pressured into it Saturday night?
So this is where it gets interesting. If we had talked 2 days ago, I would have said, no, I don't think they're going to sell, or at least they haven't so far indicated. But yesterday evening, we had a story saying that the Chinese government has indicated that they may be willing to sell the app to a non-Chinese buyer, specifically to Elon Musk. So that's the latest wrinkle in these things. Many people have raised their hands and said that they would be interested in buying TikTok. The problem is that TikTok is a very successful company, so it's quite expensive. So not that many people would actually be able to have enough money to buy the app. So that's part of this. The other thing at play here is that Trump sent a brief to the Supreme Court asking them to delay the bill, or sorry, to delay the law, their ruling on the law, until he takes office, and then he will try to find a divestiture solution. It's unclear if the justices are going to do anything with that or just continue on their main course. So we'll see what happens.
So, does President-elect Trump have to ask the Supreme Court to delay, or does he need to ask Congress to change the deadline?
So
Or he could do both, either, I
I
guess.
mean, yeah, I guess you, I mean, it's a different Congress now. So there's, I guess that this Congress is more willing to do that. The problem is that there's not that much time left, right? This we have a couple of days. So getting a law through both chambers of the House, I don't want to say it's impossible, but this would have to be their top priority right now. One
And
senator,
should it be, I guess, is probably right.
yeah, is the question. So actually, one senator, Ed Markey, actually did put out a statement yesterday saying that he was going to introduce a bill to extend the deadline for TikTok to be sold. But as I'm not sure if that has actually been introduced yet. And like we said, it's Tuesday now. This is going into effect on Sunday. So anything that's going to happen is going to need to happen very quickly.
And there seemed to be a lot of public outrage around, the use of TikTok and banning TikTok, and it was talked about a lot. Do you feel like that has cooled off in recent weeks and months? I feel like this. I don't know. I mean, maybe as Sunday approaches, it'll feel more heated. But I feel like some of it has cooled off. That spurred the action of Congress, right? That like the reason.
Yeah, it's unclear. I mean, we've been through so many waves of this. It feels like sometimes there is more of a wide interest in banning TikTok, and that's a priority for people. Sometimes there's other stuff going on. It's not as big a priority. They're trying to work out solutions behind the scenes. So it's hard to say. President-elect Trump has also gone back and forth on this issue. He originally was one of the first people who tried to ban TikTok in the US, and he kind of walked that back earlier this summer, and indicated that he may be in support of TikTok now. So it's all sort of up in the air. And I know that another company you wanted to discuss, Meta, is also kind of in the mix here, right? Meta could be a big beneficiary of TikTok getting banned.
That's what I was going to ask. I watched a video a day or two ago that was just saying, that some people say that if TikTok goes away, everyone will just find a different platform to make their videos and it'll all be fine. But this person disagreed. This person is their career is on TikTok, and they said that TikTok is not just, it's a whole community and it's not just something that can jump ship to another app.
I think that's exactly right. I think many users I've spoken to find that TikTok, they've created this community that is really difficult to replicate across apps. The way that TikTok is set up, the algorithm, the feed, it's based on content it thinks you would like. So not it's not based on content of people you follow, which means that you can go viral easier. It's easier to build an audience. It's easier to get seen. Whereas it's a bit harder to do that on Instagram, for instance. That's mostly you already need to have a following by the time you go to Instagram. So unless something new pops up, in the past few days, there have been a few new apps that have been gaining steam. They also appear to be owned by Chinese owners. So I
Same
imagine their future.
problem. Same problem.
Exactly. And the thing with the law, with the TikTok law, is it's not just limited to TikTok. So it's TikTok, ByteDance, which is their parent company, and then also broadly any app that's controlled by a foreign adversary is what the law says. So just the fact that another app might pop up, it could also go away.
All right. Well, I won't make you predict what Elon Musk is going to do, but I guess we'll have to just wait and see over the next few days.
We will.
So let's take a few minutes and turn our attention to Meta now. You mentioned Meta. Mark Zuckerberg recently announced that the company will be ending its fact-checking program. The program was aimed to stop the spread of misinformation on its social media apps, but now they're going to do user monitored content. How will having user monitored content change Instagram, Facebook? What are the thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So you can kind of see an example of this with X. So X does the same thing. They got rid of fact checkers and have what's called community notes, where any user on the platform can sign up for this program and review content and suggest context if needed. And if they decide that something does need context and enough people agree, then a note gets added to it. So you've seen this already with X. And in some ways, you're seeing stuff get fact-checked that wasn't getting fact-checked before. So, for instance, advertisements are some of the things, paid advertisements on X are some of the things that we're getting fact-checked that the company's advertising we're not happy about, right? Because they're paying to advertise and, then they're getting notes at the bottom of their posts saying that, this isn't exactly right or this isn't exactly true. So, I think there's a lot of people who think this may actually be a good thing for Meta, but someone, one of the researchers I spoke to, said that community notes works best when it's in conjunction with third-party fact checkers. So, it's maybe hard for users to do this all by themselves and to catch everything. And also the people who are the third-party fact checkers are professionally trained to do this. So that's sort of what people in the community think. I mean, some people are obviously very unhappy about this change. It's, I think, too early to sort of tell what it's going to really look like. I think it'll be, and it might also be different across different platforms, right? So what users may be trying to fact check on Facebook might be different from Instagram, might be different from Threads. So we'll, I'd be very interested to see how this goes.
Are we going to see fewer people getting their posts banned then for questionable content? You know, sometimes someone posts something that they think is innocuous and Facebook will flag it just because they had one word in it that didn't make that they didn't mean or something like that.
Yes, this is something that Mark Zuckerberg talked about in his announcement changing this, is that he felt like they were making too many mistakes when trying to take down bad content, and people's perfectly fine content was getting taken down with it. And so this is his attempt at trying to make sure that doesn't happen. The other thing that they're doing is removing restrictions on certain hate speech. So you're allowed to say more things now on the platform that you weren't allowed to before and that you would have gotten some repercussions for before.
And Zuckerberg said that he's doing this because it's time to get back to the roots of the company and free expression. But he acknowledged that bad stuff will, he said, bad stuff, more bad stuff will be on the platform. I should that be a worry for him? Did he felt like the trade-off was worth it, that the bad stuff, the free expression outweighs the bad stuff?
That's essentially what he said in his speech about this, was that there's too many mistakes being made and too much perfectly fine content that was being taken down along with the bad stuff. And so now he's doing the opposite, which is maybe under policing things. And so in that case, some quote bad stuff might be on the platform more than it was before, but he thinks the trade-off is going to be worth it.
I found some users say that they're going to post on Facebook every single day a lie, like about Mark Zuckerberg himself because they can. Have you seen that?
I have seen this. Yeah. I have seen some stuff that I'm not going to repeat on
no,
the show.
No, it's not radio friendly, but will, yeah.
And also, I would probably get sued for libel. Yeah. So, but yes, people are already starting to post things that are, as far as I understand, not to be true about Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, and every single day, on and on and on until he changes back, I guess. They want the fact checkers back.
Yeah, I mean, and that's their right to under this new policy.
Now, for better or for worse, a lot of people get their news from Facebook, from their friends posting, you know, news stories or copying, pasting things that they've read other places. So do you feel like this is going to just increase the so-called fake news generation even more?
That's a good question. I think with the, there certainly will be more content that is incorrect and is misinformation. Will users be able to see through it? I think is the question, right? There's a lot of misinformation already on the internet, and sometimes people can see through it, sometimes they can't. So I think, you know, as a reporter, it's just my job to make sure that I'm actually posting more. I'm trying to post more on social media so people can see what is actually true and what the news is. So it's, you know, just trying to do my best over here to inform people.
There are a wide variety of social media platforms to get news from, Blue Sky, Truth Social. Do you think that, do you think more people will join these less well-known social media platforms in reaction to this?
I have heard anecdotally that people are leaving Threads, for instance. I haven't looked into the data to see how much or if that's happening. The thing that Mark Zuckerberg is betting here is that there's basically no better alternative, right? A lot of people left X for Instagram and Threads because they didn't like what Elon Musk was doing with the platform. And so, you know, there's the Meta owned apps, there's TikTok for 5 more days, there's X, but there's not really a lot of other places to go that are well populated. And that seems to be what Mark Zuckerberg is betting on here.
All right. Well, we'll have to see what happens. Thank you for joining us today. That was Wall Street Journal technology reporter Megan Bobrowski. She covers TikTok, Meta, and other social media. Thank you for being here, Megan.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about a new online experience from Nationwide Children's Hospital that aims to improve the mental health of teens. That's when Tech Tuesday continues on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News. This is a show where we share stories and information about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're talking about a new web-based suicide prevention and education program for teens that can be completed on a computer, tablet, or cell phone. It's called Be Present Ohio, the online experience. And here to tell us more are two people who were involved in developing it. Dr. John Ackerman is a pediatric psychologist and a suicide prevention clinical manager at the Center for Suicide Prevention and Research at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Welcome, Dr. Ackerman.
Thanks so much for having me, Amy.
And Ben Miller, he is a suicide prevention project manager and the lead facilitator in the creation of Be Present Ohio, the online experience. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you so much.
So first off, Dr. Ackerman, let's start with you telling us how your team came up with the idea to create an online program for teens for mental health and to prevent suicide.
So we've been partnering with the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation and the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services to think how we could creatively offer kids new ways of learning about mental health, learning about suicide risk, and in the light of all that's going on, be able to engage in this material in a safe and innovative way that helps them learn how to apply these skills to save lives.
So we know that teens love their technology. Did you see this as an innovative way to meet kids where they are?
Yeah. Absolutely. We saw that there was a gap in how kids are learning about this and in relation to how they spend most of their time learning about new things, which is online. How can we marry the two and help them take something that is a tough topic, but also something that we know is so critical to their learning and what they're facing today? So we thought that using technology to learn about this and to reinforce the types of skills that we know can help them cope and keep them safe was a great combination.
Now, Ben, you actually helped develop the actual program. So it's called Be Present Ohio, the online experience. Can you describe it for our listeners?
Yeah, so it's a Be Present Ohio, the online experience is a web-based program where students are going to be logging on to our website and they're going to be creating their accounts in order to complete our program. It's an educational program that we broke down into three different levels. Each one is going to be targeting kind of a different core competency in that suicide prevention space that we kind of know to be best practices for young people. So that's a pretty cool new way.
So whenever they log in, and you say they're creating an account, what are they doing in the experience? What will they see, and what are the actions they're taking?
Yeah, so what they're going to be doing is primarily our educational content is presented to students in a series of short videos. Each one lasts about 2 minutes or so that we designed to kind of simulate or look like TikTok or YouTube videos so that it's kind of presenting information in a way that youth are digesting leisure time information as well. So they'll be logging in, they'll work through this series of videos. After each short video, there's going to be a brief activity that reinforces the content that they just watched in the video, and then they're going to be reinforced for doing that. We have a pretty cool gamified system built into the program. So as students play through the levels and move through the different videos, they're going to be unlocking achievements. They're going to be leveling and ranking up. We have a point system built in with a little avatar that they can actually customize as they go through the program. And they can use those points to unlock different shirts, different clothes, different attire. And we really tried to be very intentional when we were developing that avatar so that way kids could see themselves represented up on screen if they wanted to.
Speaking from experience of having a preteen, developing your own avatar and being able to pick out the outfit is very important.
Yeah, if I could add to that, I think part of what we know about depression and suicide risk is that kids don't always feel seen or feel connected. And so how we were building this program was thinking about, can we make sure that there's every opportunity for a young person to build a character that represents themselves? It doesn't even have to be themselves. It could be an alien, a cowboy, whatever you want to reflect yourself as. And then you can kind of earn points by doing things that we know are helping you cope anyway. And then you can buy things and do things that'll be fun for you.
Who's your target audience?
Our target audience is really that middle school to high school group of kids, those young people who can have and are having meaningful conversations about mental health, but also can really go through this program in a self-paced way, facilitated by a trusted adult, but really someone who can dig into this material, learn about themselves, learn about what helps keep them safe and navigating tough times, but also old enough to know sometimes it's time to reach out to a trusted adult. Sometimes it's important to make sure you have your set of skills to get through a tough time.
Can any teen play this, or is it something that a doctor or a counselor has to recommend to get you access?
That's a great question, and I'm going to let Ben talk about that because we aren't at the point where it's a prescribed type of situation. We do want it facilitated by an adult, but I'll let Ben talk through.
It's not a prescribed or
no, it's not something we want just to give to an individual right now. We may get to that point where we're at a situation where someone could say, "Oh, this would be good for you to take," but because we're early stages, we want to evaluate what situations it's effective for. We want to make sure it starts in a way that's facilitated by a trusted adult, like an organizational leader, a counselor, a teacher, someone who's able to sit with a group of kids and provide that guidance that we know works really well in other research.
Okay, Ben, tell me about people getting access to it then.
Yeah, so a lot of the times where we're rolling out BPOXP is with our school partners and our community organization partners.
Well, all those letters you just said, is that what BPO, so it's Be yeah. Present Ohio, the online experience. Is that
yeah,
what you
apologies.
Call it? Into,
yeah, yeah. yeah. So we rather than saying Be Present Ohio, the online experience, we just shortened it to BPOXP. It's our abbreviation for the program.
That's fine, yes. Just trying to keep up with you. Okay, now back to the task at hand. How do you get it to people?
So we roll it out primarily with our school-based partners and our community-based partners who are already kind of serving youth. So the program, as Dr. Ackerman mentioned, is actually facilitated by a staff member who is going to be doing it with groups of students. The staff members who are facilitating the program typically come from that organization. So like if we rolled it out at a high school, it would be a high school teacher. It would be an adult volunteer at some of our after-school programming. But really anybody who knows how to work with young people has the opportunity to serve as a facilitator for the program. We actually host trainings for anyone who serves as a facilitator, and that's part of our onboarding process, is we teach you how do you help youth engage with the program, what makes a good digital mental health program. We also talk about, you know, how to respond in safe ways for young people as we kind of navigate some of these conversations. Our program really focuses on messages of hope and strength-based interventions, but we still always have people ready to go with, if somebody's having a tough time, how can you be a trusted adult in their lives and come alongside them?
So if a school counselor, as a part of their day, meets with students, the school counselor could sign up and say, my group of students who I meet with every Wednesday is going to go through this program. Is that what you hope happens?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways that we could see this being helpful. It could be an already existing club. It could be an entire grade of students in middle school or high school. It could be an after-school program that really wants to make sure their kids have the extra tools to be resilient, safe, and knowledgeable of how to respond to another child who's at risk of suicide. So I think we see it as actually being very flexible, which was one, it gets back to your original question, like, what's the goal here? It fills a gap. It actually gets to address sort of the idea that we're seeing risk for mental health challenges and suicide risk in many different settings, and not all kids show these signs in every single setting. So the more we have kids aware of what to look for, how to respond, that they're confident in their ability to do that, we're going to have a much safer environment for kids to be in. And our goal overall is, of course, to reduce suicide in our community, which has only escalated over the past 15 years. So we're really looking to address this in ways that aren't just replicating some of the unhelpful ways in the past, that we're really digging into where kids are, what they're seeing, and in a way that they're going to respond to.
Do you have to have a connection to Nationwide Children's Hospital to use this, or are you hoping to roll it out all everywhere?
Yeah, so we are available across the entire state of Ohio. As long as you have an Ohio zip code, we're able to get you in touch with this program. I kind of do the day-to-day management of kind of getting people connected with the program, getting them trained and all that stuff. But we are throughout the entire state, and there's no requirement to have like a direct relationship with Nationwide Children's Hospital. We work with partners down in Cleveland. We work with partners down in Cincinnati. We have a couple of implementing sites over near the Akron area and near Dayton. So we're really spreading as far and wide as we can across the state.
And if I could add to that, yeah. I mean, the most important part for a lot of partners is that it's free and funded by the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation and Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, because they see that there's this huge unmet need. And the more we can spread the word, the more we can get organizations using best practices to help young people. I think it's a really win-win for a lot of folks.
I know it's new. Do you hope it can go beyond Ohio, or is it just you want it to, it's Ohio's right now?
It's really the plan due to the funders and our support is to make sure Ohio is supported and we can expand. However, from the very beginning, we did talk about the idea, and we've actually had national conversations with other folks seeing the value in this, that as we meet our needs locally here in Ohio, this would be a model as we evaluate it. And if it shows the outcomes that we hope it does, that we would expand and kind of debrand it.
So this is relatively new, and teens can be very harsh critics. Ben, what kind of initial response have you been getting?
From our initial rollouts, we got feedback, and this was not what we were necessarily expecting, that it was a little bit too boring. And that's coming from teens, from the idea of TikTok. Like, I'm watching a 10-second video, I'm watching a 15-second video.
Were your videos too long?
They did. You know, we were at the 2-minute mark, and that was considered too long for some of our young people. But I mean, apart from that, which we were kind of actually expecting for young people to say, you know, hey, why isn't this more like we're playing Mario? Like, that would be fun for us. Yeah. Which we did our best to make it as gamified as possible. And once we kind of moved through some of those, hey, you know, this is where the program fits all of our folks that we were piloting with and our young people that we talked with, they were talking to us about how they enjoyed the avatar, about how it was really fun to be able to share that with their friends to show, hey, I got my pet unicorn. What did you get for your pet? We really had kids also enjoying what we call our cope ahead plan. At the end of our program, so at the end of level 3, students are presented with this PDF of what we call the cope ahead plan, which is a temporary compilation of their responses from some of the activities throughout the program that will have kind of a reminder for them, or seeds planted, as it were, of what we learned from the program. So it'll be things like, who are trusted adults in my life? What are some coping skills that I might want to try that I practice during the program? What are good conversation starters when I need to check in on myself or check in with a friend? And so we've had a lot of positive response from young people about really, really valuing, you know, having something I can take with me from the program that I generated, because we didn't want it to be something that was, you know, we told 1,000 kids, take a deep breath, right? We wanted it to be something where young people could have an engaging experience, choose what they wanted to learn from this quality content that we gave them, and then really take that ownership of it and bring it with them into their lives once they're done with the program.
So to earn the unicorn, as an example, since that was the example you offered, to earn a pet unicorn, do you have to, so the program will ask you, like, who are the trusted adults in your life? And do they have to answer, or is it something they just need to think about?
Yeah, so we have the activities structured in such a way. We actually provide students who go through the program with a notebook. It's our BPO-XP notebook. And so we encourage them to be kind of taking notes, and they will be like listing out who are my trusted adults. We'll actually have prompts on screen for them, and they can either choose to write it down or type it into the program itself. We do really want them to be putting in these actionable items. So while we do have some of these activities that are a little bit more thought-based, we have a lot of really tangible things that they can do and think about and apply to their lives.
And if I can add too, we've added in real life quests. So there are some
in real life quests. Okay.
Yeah, so our IRLs allow a young person to also earn points by having conversations with their parents, with their caregivers, with other friends in their lives outside of the program that they can come back. And since it's typically done in a couple of segments, that they can come back the next day, enter their sort of behavioral responses that they did, and add points to for doing things in their world, which is a gap in a lot of the programs that we don't always see kids using the things that they learn from programs in their real life. So really, we felt very strongly we had to have opportunities for kids to take what they were learning, what they were doing, and apply them to their real life. And to Ben's point, one of the cooler things is that you've got kids who are playing this gamified curriculum, learning a lot, and then at the end of it, they're not sort of filling out this giant form. They've just, their answers, what they care about, who they would turn to, what they would do if they were stressed, all generates into this cope ahead plan that they get at the end of the program. So without knowing it, they're actually getting their personalized plan to keep themselves safe in a crisis, which they take with them. So it's a really tangible takeaway from the program. In addition to the fun gamified and avatar components, there's a real practical tool that they take with them.
Do you have a component for the parent or trusted adult in their life to learn what they're learning? Because, you know, as a parent, I wouldn't know what questions to ask. I wouldn't know, like, did you get a unicorn today? I wouldn't know what to say. Do you have like a cheat sheet for the parents or trusted adults?
We do have a lot of materials that are available for caregivers and resources that go with them. I wish we could get the parents in the room, and that's sort of our dream with some of our programs. But we generally have resources links at our Center for Suicide Prevention and Research website.
Now, cybersecurity is a big concern. When you were making this, I mean, if they're entering in personal information, how can everyone be sure that it's safe?
Yeah, great question. So being a hospital, you know, we really care about the privacy and kind of the information that is entrusted to us as an entity. So we use a learning management system that's called Brainier that powers a lot of our community-facing trainings that we do at the hospital. And it is considered secure by HIPAA standards. So it is something that anything that goes in there is under lock and key. As an added layer of security we have, though, for our young people is we actually provide them with instructions to create anonymous accounts. So everybody has the same first name, the same last name. So there's not anything that's identifiable for the student. When kids are going through the program, that COPE ahead plan that I mentioned, and you know, Dr. Ackerman talked about how the responses are saved, they're saved until the end of the program. When I, on my account, click complete the program, all that information is deleted from the cloud, from the internet, as it were. Students will still have that PDF that they downloaded, but none of this information is stored or saved. What we know with these types of digital mental health interventions is that the more we can allow this to be a experience that a student gets to have ownership of and isn't worried about, like, you know, is the big eye watching me in the sky, they learn a lot more and they're more comfortable and honest with themselves in the program. And so we really try to make that a space where, you know, we are upfront with students on, like, you're going to be having this experience, but we are not monitoring you. We are not taking your information. This is just for you to have a good experience. And so that we can make sure that, you know, you are not accidentally getting into Tim's profile.
The only thing I might add too is that there are programs which ask specifically about a child's level of depression or anxiety or suicide risk. This is not a program that asks those screening questions. Ben and I would be happy to talk through any interested organization or person about how we manage the information that's stored and saved, but that's it's not a we're not collecting information about a child's status. It's not a research project, and we don't keep personalized information like that.
Okay. And if a parent or trusted adult is hearing this right now and they know someone that they want to have access to this, can they do it as an individual, or do you need it to be school-based or club-based?
Right now, we're generally having it as part of a group or organization, or in a way somewhat facilitated. We don't necessarily have a minimum size of group, but we want it to be facilitated so that a young person, if they experience distress, there's a lot of research that shows these types of programs do not increase distress, but it is a topic that warrants thoughtful conversations, responses, availability of that trusted adult. So right now we're keeping it as a facilitated experience, but it'd be really easy for folks, if they have any questions or they feel like it would be a good fit for a group or a type of a young person, then you could reach out to Ben or I.
Have you tried to reach out to, like, a bigger school district? Obviously Columbus City Schools is the biggest district around here. Is it something they're interested in implementing?
So we work closely with Columbus City Schools on a number of initiatives, suicide prevention related, one called The Signs of Suicide, and their leadership has been fantastic. We are just introducing this idea. We want to make sure they're continuing to use best practices across the board, and we think this would be a great adjunct. So I don't want to get too much into specifics as we're just sort of like starting to think about what would be helpful. But we have worked with a number of school districts and organizations like Boys and Girls Clubs, and Ben can talk about some of the partners, districts that we've been working
with. You had to have partners to get it started. So who are some of those?
Yeah, so we've actually worked a lot with some folks here in the Columbus area when we were starting off. We had some folks over at Femergy here actually at OSU who kind of helped us out with piloting. We had Boys and Girls Club, as John mentioned. We've worked with a lot of private schools in the area as well as a couple of the college preparatory academies who have been kind of rolling this out. We've also had a couple of homeschool groups who have reached out to us. So we've rolled this out with as small as a group of four kids in a kind of a homeschool group setting. But we've also, DeSales was one of our first implementers last year when we opened up in January and kind of launched the program. And they rolled it out with just over 200 of their senior students. They chose to do it with their whole grade and their government classes. We've had some really good conversations with 1 in 5 down in the Cincinnati area, south, that's right. And then also with Life Act up in the Cleveland area as well. So we've had a lot of interest across the board about this program.
And we've been talking about the game Be Present Ohio, the online experience. And I have to add, if there is a teen who is struggling or needs help, they can call or text the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988 or text For Hope to 741-741. And just before we leave, Dr. Ackerman, is there anywhere else, if a teen is struggling, where can they reach out for Nationwide Children's Hospital?
Sure. Locally, folks can reach out in the Franklin County Psychiatric Crisis Line, 614-722-1800, or 988. They can text or call or chat anytime. Those are probably the two primary. I will say, if folks are more interested in the program, we actually have a video, a sizzle reel. They could go to Be Present Ohio, just Google that, and then click on the BPOXP tab, and they could learn a little bit more, share it with colleagues, and find that help that way.
All right. That was Dr. John Ackerman, a pediatric psychologist and suicide prevention clinical manager at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Thanks for being here, John.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Ben Miller, the lead facilitator of Be Present Ohio, the online experience. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thank you so much, Amy. It was a pleasure.
And coming up, we're going to talk about e-bikes. Are they a good way to avoid heavy city traffic? That's when Tech Tuesday continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Many people are looking for alternatives to driving, hoping to avoid heavy city traffic. And as cities struggle with congestion, one potential alternative is to the driving and traffic is using a foldable electric bike. Joining me now is Russell Hawley, managing editor for commerce at CNET. And we're going to talk more about these electric bikes. So welcome to the show, Russell. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
How do e-bikes compare to those electric scooters that have been everywhere in a lot of major cities?
Electric scooters, they're not designed to go particularly fast. So when it comes to crossing a street, they don't, quickly get out of a car's way. There are very specific places where you're allowed to ride them. And unfortunately, most of those end up being sidewalks. So they're kind of a nuisance to pedestrians. Most cyclists who will bother with an e-bike in the first place, which is usually just cities or places where there's, pretty significant hills, they can ride right where the cars ride. If there's not a dedicated bike lane, they're not a nuisance to pedestrians. They can typically travel much faster and safely. And the folks using them are very, very well aware of, the rules of the road and the safety regulations associated with them.
Is an e-bike a big investment compared to just buying like a normal bike that's powered by you? Are they
expensive? It very much depends on how much you want to spend. Mm-hmm. We've seen prices come down in them pretty significantly. 2 to 3 years ago, the average e-bike was close to $2,000 for kind of a mid-range one, and they went up pretty considerably from there. And very recently, we've started seeing some very nice electric bikes come down below $1,000 and be something that is easy to recommend for someone, even if they are, kind of an avid cyclist already. Mm.
So what's the basic running time for a battery on an e-bike? How far can you get?
It very much depends. Capacity is usually listed right on the bike, but an average is typically around 50 miles. And that depends on how hilly the area you are in, how much of the powered assist you request from the bike when riding. If you are the kind of person who really likes to the actually like pedaling motion of riding a bike, typically you can extend that out to as far as 80 miles. And if you are in a hilly area and you want the bike to do all the work, that can drop as far as 25 to 30 miles.
Mm. And how is being foldable help to make e-bikes more practical for people?
The biggest challenge associated with an e-bike, especially one that you've invested a whole bunch of money in, is where you're going to put it when you are either at work or at a grocery mm-hmm. store or, going to see a movie or something like that. And while a lot of establishments will have bike racks outside, especially if you are in an area that has limited apartment space or you're in an office that just doesn't have a ton of room, having a full-size bike that is propped up somewhere, even if it's just one bike, can be an inconvenience. And if it's a bunch of them, it can be a lot worse. The way that foldable bikes tend to work is there's a hinge point in the middle of the bike, the actual like frame that takes it and folds it almost exactly in half. That makes it much easier to store in a closet or to, put in a corner of a room where it's considerably less distracting. That doesn't really solve the retail solution, which is why, you still want to have a good, bike chain or something, but it's also convenient to toss in the back of a car in the event that you want to take your bike somewhere else to ride it.
Yeah, I was going to ask how small it gets. So probably just half, right?
It is definitely just half. And, there's still a considerable weight associated with that. Batteries weigh a bunch. The motors that go into those batteries weigh a bunch. So if you're thinking about a bike that you would see at Walmart or Target, you pick them up and they're not that heavy. E-bikes tend to weigh a fair bit more because batteries are pretty heavy, and the extra gear that goes into it can take up space. So while you are able to fold the bike in half, if you're by having it in half, you've got those two wheels that you can rely on still to push into places and to kind of pull up things. But having it so that you're lifting it up to putting it somewhere can be a challenge for some.
And if you're in traffic, I mean, if you're on an e-bike, you can go, can you go faster than pedaling?
It very much depends on the bike you have. There are some, a lot of the bikes have governor style limitations installed in them so that you can't exceed 20 miles an hour, because that can be kind of dangerous in different environments if you're able to do that, especially in a major city where a car may not be able to see you in time to react if you are going 30 or 40 miles an hour. You are able to go, faster than most people would be able to pedal without a fair bit of experience.
Yeah, there is some of the trails around here in Columbus. There is a little bit of a community of they don't want the e-bikes on the trail because that's not what it's for, kind of thing, because they're going too fast.
We definitely have a similar bike trail system around here, and there are now signs posted that, ask to keep it below 15 miles an hour, which is consistent with what a healthy cyclist would be able to do. But yeah, that it's definitely you have to play nice with pedestrians because you are going quite fast and you are quite heavy, and accidents are more often than not going to be your fault as the cyclist.
Another topic you wanted to talk about, moving on from e-bikes, is shopping and planning out dinners for you and your family. That can be difficult and can be time-consuming. There's a number of companies out there offering delivery meals that contain ingredients and instructions, and you prepare and share. Russell, what do you say about the cost of these meal deliveries compared to shopping for your own ingredients?
Yeah, so this is it very much depends on the kind of household you have, right? Like if it's just a one person, two person, or three person household, then some of these meal kits end up being quite affordable, because you end up buying exactly the ingredients that you need in order to make that one meal, and you don't have a ton left over. You're a larger household, and that ends up being kind of inconvenient. You can use, whatever your best judgment is there. This is typically the time of year where folks are really interested in being healthy, and so meal kits offer that kind of added benefit of, you're not ordering junk food, you're not, loading up on sweets when you go to the grocery store. You're able to, kind of plan your meals in advance and know exactly what it is that you're putting in your body. This is something that got really popular during COVID lockdowns and, has continued for some folks. But usually around this time of year, there are folks that are looking at these kind of things as, kind of a meal replacement. And one of the really interesting things that have happened over the last 2 years is there are now so many of these services that a lot of them are starting to compete on price, where it used to be, a single week of these meal kits can be as expensive as $80 to $100 for a couple to order these services for. There are now a lot of these that are coming down to around $6 a serving.
That's much more reasonably priced. My family used to belong to one of these, and it kind of got exhausting. We got behind on using the meals from time to time, and my kids are picky, so they wouldn't eat it. So is it worth it for some people, but maybe not everyone?
It very much depends on the kind of diet that you enjoy and whether or not the service offers the things that you want and whether you're willing to kind of put in the time. One of the things that you just mentioned there is, getting a meal that you're maybe not super excited about. Almost all of these services now have the ability to plan out those meals in advance, where you'll get an email, saying, here are the meals that we have available for this coming month. You can pick the ones that you're interested in, and those will be the ones that get sent out. There are also a couple of these meal services that understand that you kind of don't want to do that every single night of the week. So they set up subscriptions where maybe it's three meals a week that get sent out instead of four or five or seven.
Yeah, I think I got overwhelmed. I think I had too many coming. There's also kits where you make the meal, but then I've seen an increase, especially in the past 2 years, of the meal coming to you in a box and you heat it up.
That's exactly right. We have somehow impossibly resurrected TV dinners. And a big part of that is having, the focus on them being higher quality ingredients and, kind of a greater variety of the meals that arrive. Very much the same concept, though. These are designed to either toss into an air fryer or a microwave or an oven. There are usually multiple sets of instructions for how you prefer to heat it up. And depending on how complex you end up getting it, some of them arrive in separate containers so that you can bake one and microwave the other and then put it all together on a plate as a single meal. So it's a little more complicated than, just tossing something in a microwave. But yeah, it is certainly for folks who just don't enjoy the act of cooking, a pretty great alternative.
It has the packaging got better over the years? Because I, when I got these kits, it was years ago, and there was just a lot in the box that wasn't food.
It's still a fair bit of cardboard, and it's still a fair bit of those, you know, kind of reusable freezer packs. There are a couple of these companies that have gotten better about a recycling program where you can send some of the freezer packs back, but it is still a non-trivial amount of waste in some cases.
Well, Russell, I wanted to talk with you about space heaters, but we have run out of time. So can you come back next week and we'll talk about space heaters, because I have opinions.
I absolutely can.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. That is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you so much for joining me, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll talk with Russell again next week. This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.